This is another edition of Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. The music of writing, it filters into fiction and even nonfiction, but for many years, for my writing, starting with the poetry, the music of it and the sound of it is one of the most important factors. Was Lawrence Ferlinghetti who commented, to which I agree, that a lot of modern poetry is chopped up prose. So for me, the poetry, virtually all the time, it has to sing, it has to flow along. A lot of times more complicated than a lot of song lyrics are really a lot of couplets and quatrains and such like with simple rhymes. So poetry tends to be a little more elaborate, is my general impression. And over the years, I don't keep track, but I would say that about 90% of my album collection is non-lyrics, because I am very particular about what I hear, not only as far as the poetic language of it, but also what you might call the affirmations or the mantras or just the messages in the songs. If I don't like the lyrics, or they say something in a way that I find, you know, not conscious enough, I don't want to listen to it. So for the most part, I listen to music, and so I think in some subtle way it's flavored my writings, all different kinds of music, ambient, jazz, rock, you know, world music, different cultures, various traditions. So it's a hodgepodge. And an interesting thing I heard Pink Floyd, or I read in an article some years ago, that one of their decisions with their songs was to have, if you listen to the songs, there's a lot of time for the music, so they're not overwhelmed by the lyrics. So it's a nice balance. From what I know, it was a conscious choice, balance the lyrics with the musical feel and the experience. So I wanted to give a few examples of some of my favorite kind of inspiring texts and poems and fiction. When I read them, it's the flavor of, I think, without totally consciously choosing, but it's what seeps into my writings. Here's one example by Dylan Thomas, A Child's Christmas in Wales, which begins, "One Christmas was so much like the other in those years around the sea town corner now. Out of all sound, except the distant speaking of the voices I sometimes hear a moment before sleep, that I can never remember whether it snowed for 6 days and 6 nights when I was 12, or whether it snowed for 12 days and 12 nights when I was 6. All the Christmases roll down towards the two-tongued sea like a cold and headlong moon bundling down the sky that was our street. And they stop at the rim of the ice-edged, fish-freezing waves, and I plunge my hands in the snow and bring out whatever I can find." And another huge influence on my personal writings is Gerard Manley Hopkins, a Jesuit priest from 1844 to 1889. One of his poems is "Pied Beauty." And a lot of times you could read and not even know what the heck he's talking about, but I like it anyway. Here's one. It's one of his more famous ones, "Pied Beauty." "Glory be to God for dappled things, for skies of couple color as a brinded cow, for rose moles all in stipple upon trout that swim, fresh fire coal, chestnut falls, finches wings, landscape plotted and pieced, fold fallow and plow, and all trades, their gear and tackle and trim. All things counter, original, spare, strange. Whatever is fickle, freckled, who knows how, with swift, slow, sweet, sour, a dazzle dim, he fathers forth whose beauty is past change. Praise him." I can almost hear the jazz or Thelonious Monk rhythms in that poem. And another poet does that in a different way, Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Here's one from A Coney Island of the Mind, one of the best-selling poetry books ever, I think, over like a million copies the last time I heard. And this is a long poem. I'm just going to read the beginning, some of the beginning. It's called The Long Street. The long street, which is the street of the world, passes around the world, filled with all the people of the world, not to mention all the voices of all the people that ever existed. Lovers and weepers, virgins and sleepers, spaghetti salesmen and sandwich men, milkmen and orators, boneless bankers, brittle housewives sheathed in nylon snobberies, deserts of advertising men, herds of high school fillies, crowds of collegians all talking and walking around or hanging out windows to see what's doing out in the world, where everything happens sooner or later, if it happens at all. And the long street, which is the longest street in all the world, but which isn't as long as it seems, passes on through all the cities and all the scenes, down every alley, up every boulevard, through every crossroads, through red lights and green lights, cities in sunlight, continents in rain, hungry Hong Kongs, untillable Tuscaloosas, Oaklands of the soul, Dublins of the imagination. And the long street rolls on around like an enormous choo-choo train chugging around the world, and it goes on and on that way. So it's definitely got a, it's got a catchy rhythm. And also I'll mention one time hearing a little bit of the Lakota language, then I heard just the sound and the rhythm of it, and then I heard an oriole singing, and the rhythm and the pace of it reminded me of the, a little bit of the Lakota. And that sounds amazing, and it is to me, but I guess some of it makes sense because I've heard natives say that that a lot of times, or I don't know about across the board, but the language comes from, their language comes from the earth and the birds and, you know, all of nature. So in that sense, it makes sense. So I think that's really helpful for a writer too, to listen to, you know, to go outside and listen to the wind, listen to the bird songs, listen to the sounds and the rhythms, and try to pick up the feel of those as much as what they're saying. And a follow up to last week's show, a little bit of John Steinbeck's Cannery Row, because oftentimes it too is, you know, quote fiction, but it has the poetic flow sometimes more than others in the book, a little bit like Dylan Thomas. And then here's he's in Cannery Row, he's describing some of the town after it's quieted in the evening. The bums who retired in disgust under the black cypress tree come out to sit on the rusty pipes in the vacant lot. The girls from Dora's emerge for a bit of sun, if there is any. Doc strolls from the Western Biological Laboratory and crosses the street to Lee Chong's grocery for two quarts of beer. Henry the painter noses like an Airedale through the junk in the grass-grown lot for some part or piece of wood or metal he needs for the boat he is building. Then the darkness edges in and the street light comes on in front of Dora's, the lamp which makes perpetual moonlight in Cannery Row. Callers arrive at Western Biological to see Doc, and he crosses the street to Lee Chong's for five quarts of beer. How can the poem and the stink and the grating noise, the quality of light, the tone, the habit, and the dream be set down alive? When you collect marine animals, there are certain flatworms so delicate that they are almost impossible to capture whole, for they break and tatter under the touch. You must let them ooze and crawl of their own will onto a knife blade, and then lift them gently into your bottle of sea water. And perhaps that might be the way to write this book, to open the page and to let the stories crawl in by themselves. So that's a wonderful, that's in the introductory section of Cannery Row. What a great guideline, I think, for writing, to open the page and let the stories crawl in by themselves, like flatworms. Very organic, and again, very listening and being receptive to what's going on out there as much as inside, and kind of, yeah, riding the rhythms and the sounds and the feeling that comes with that, and see where it goes. So thanks for listening and be well.